Hi, everyone. This is Kyler from Feeding Matters. Coming to you on August 22nd is the 2025 Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. This year, we're going deeper. We're hearing from more professionals. In fact, we're going to hear from all four domains of PFD, as well as the two domains from ARFID. And we're going to look across lifespans, starting with neonatology and going all the way to adulthood. Most importantly, we're highlighting the lived experience. So if you want to come together with other professionals who are engaged and dedicated to serving families and children who struggle to eat while hearing from those families directly, this is your opportunity. We'll see you on August 22nd.
Presented by Feeding Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Feeding Does Matter. My name is Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, and I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington.
So, Haley, we have two great guests today. It's so unique because these guests don't know each other. We know one very well and are learning more about the other. We are continuing on with our speaker spotlights from our upcoming Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit coming August 22nd and on demand the following months. And so I would love to introduce our two guests today. We have our micro keynotes for the summit today. And so first, we've got the micro keynote preparing for NICU discharge with Dr. Vincent C. Smith. And then we've got the micro keynote first things first in feeding therapy, prioritizing curiosity and safety with Marcia Dunkline, pediatric occupational therapist. Welcome, Dr. Smith and Marcia.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good to be here.
We really just love these like speaker spotlights because I know we're not getting everything that's going into the keynotes or the different sessions, but it gives us a chance to learn more about the individuals behind the session. And that's been really interesting for us. I would love to just start with bio and background. Dr. Smith, we'll start with you and then Marcia, we'll turn to you.
Okay. So I'm a neonatologist and I'm division of chief of newborn medicine at Boston Medical Center, Boston University. And, I've been working on NICU discharge preparation and transition planning as my academic interest for the majority of my career, actually, basically starting right after fellowship. And so I've done a lot of work in this area. In fact, I was working my work with the National Perinatal Association. Like 2 years ago, we came out with national guidelines for NICU discharge preparation and transition planning. And I think that's part of how I came into to kind of your orbit was with this particular work. So I'm pretty passionate about how we help families get ready for discharge, and feeding is huge. So
wonderful. Thanks for being here. And yeah, Marcia.
Hi, I'm Marcia Dunkline. I'm a pediatric occupational therapist, and I've been doing feeding for a lot of decades, and I have a passion for pediatric feeding. I really believe in families and believe in supporting children in the most compassionate and responsive way. I've been involved with Feeding Matters since you started. I've been
very beginning
hanging around you, and I love what Feeding Matters is doing. I love your mission. I love your vision. And I love how you're trying to really navigate complicated parts in the feeding world to get us all to talk together and just make things better in the world of feeding for families. So thank you for all you're doing.
Thanks, Marcia. Really great to have you here. And this conversation, like we were talking earlier, is what we're trying to do is figure out how do we continue to have conversations? How do we continue to collaborate? And so in that collaboration lens, there's so much talk about what does a team look like? What does multidisciplinary care look like? And I know it's got many different names. But in your mind, Marcia, for the next 3 to 5 years, where do you think that's going, that collaboration to support families?
You know, I think we're just going to get better because we're listening and we're collaborating and we're talking. And so that will just make things better. I think one area where I see things are going to begin looking a little bit different, I think we're going to be having more virtual teams. You know, there are real live brick and mortar teams in lots of places around the country that are great. And so many teams are working out of early intervention, out of small towns where there aren't big, huge teams. And I think when I talk about virtual teams, what I mean is I'm from a smallish town, and we don't have my clinic wasn't a medical clinic. It was a pediatric clinic without doctors, but we had to develop really good relationships with our doctors, really good relationships with the specialists, with the neonatologists, the pulmonologists, the GI docs. So I think we need to celebrate both brick and mortar kinds of teams and also better collaboration with virtual teams so that we're all talking, because as we know, feeding requires teams. I have a couple more things. One is that I think we're going to be doing more group and telehealth kind of support in the outlying areas, because I think we can reach families there. I hope, beyond hope, that in the next 3 to 5 years, we are reducing waiting lists, because there's no reason any child or any family should not have support immediately. And I'm going to say a little aside, I think in the next 3 to 5 years, I think we're going to see an elevation of the role of OT in the area of ARFID, because I think that's an area that's expanding as we learn more about sensory impact of all of feeding.
Yeah. Thanks, Marcia.
Marcia, that's so exciting. That was such an inspirational answer. I would say, you know, and it's interesting because when you look at it with the discharge preparation lens, like one of the things that we say is that all of the preparation has to be individualized for the family that's in front of you and for the resources that are available. But resources aren't evenly distributed, and there is often a shortage of things. And so specifically, outpatient feeding support is not always there. And so this whole concept of having virtual options and being able to support and have that be part of the transition so families have a safety net under them, that's just fantastic. I think that'll be very exciting in the upcoming years.
And Dr. Smith, you know, I think one of the things that worries me is that the distribution of resources is not even. And even in my career, I've seen resources be lessened rather than more as funding gets changed and rearranged. And it's very sad to me. So that's an area that we're going to have to all kind of keep on top of, because every family deserves support.
Absolutely. But, you know, one of the things that Feeding Matters has done, which has been really great, is to come up with creative ways to help get help and support into the hands of families. I'm thinking specifically the online tools that were developed to help kind of help assess feeding issues at home. And some of them are questions that the families themselves can fill out and don't have to have another provider to kind of, you know, be able to administer that. And they make these resources free and available. And so things like that can kind of shift a little bit, like how this information is available. And I think that that will help. And I think you're right. This whole resources getting cut thing is real. And we're all experiencing that, especially right now. Like everything that was potentially on the fringe in any way is getting trimmed back. And so what's going to have to happen is for the rest of us are going to have to think really concretely and kind of creatively how we can still support our families given our limited resources. And I think more telehealth visits, more like online questionnaires, more the things that can be done that don't require as much person power, but still give you still excellent results, it's going to have to be part of our focus.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
I completely agree with both of you. And so, Dr. Smith, I know you agreed with Marcia's emerging trends or what she's kind of looking at. Is there anything else that you have been thinking about as it relates to emerging trends over the next few years?
So I think part of the work that we've done in helping to establish guidelines is because there really weren't any, you know, mm-hmm. And so it was all kind of locally created. And as Marcia said, like local resources are not evenly distributed. And a lot of times people are just, you know, they're doing the best they can, mm-hmm. but they don't know what they should be asking. And families didn't have a toolkit or a tool resources. Like, these are the things that you should know about. These are the things that you should be getting. So they didn't even know what to advocate for themselves, you know, during the time. And you've been through the NICU. You know, for most families, that is like the worst time of their life ever. And they are not at their best. And then to just be trying to like have to improvise with something that's not in their area of specialty is not helpful. And it's really stressful. It makes a stressful situation even worse. So these guidelines, part of that was to kind of help demystify what needs to be known and just put everybody at a level playing field to start with. And I think part of what has to happen now is that now that they exist is we have to make sure that they get into hands of every family that needs them and, you know, every hospital and every administration so they can come up with programs that are based on the resources that are available and both the local resources, online resources, and national resources and make best use of these practices. And, you know, to make sure that the families are getting the support that they need for this transition. And I always like to say, you know, this period of transition kind of sets up patterns of interaction for this family with this child. And those patterns don't stop, you know, like they kind of go on. And so it's helpful to set up healthy functional patterns now so that those things can continue and improve the developmental outcomes for the kids and help make the transition better for the families.
Yeah.
Yes. So important. And I think one of the things that Feeding Matters is doing so nicely is they're also spending a lot of time listening to families and their lived experiences. What do you need? What was there? What helped? What didn't help? All across the spectrum from pediatric feeding disorder to adults who have ARFID. And so the emerging trend of really listening to people who have the lived experiences is critical in all that we're going to be doing in the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. And I think you both make such a great point that actually like really works in unison really well together, because it's like, how do we pair the listening with the need for national, international resources and resource mm-hmm. development, but then disseminating them at a local level, because every local area looks so different. And that's, and like getting kind of that algorithm right is very challenging to support families, but making sure we're taking what we're hearing, applying it broadly, but then applying it very specifically is really important.
Absolutely. And that brings home another point, which you've hinted at before, is that like from the very beginning, families have to be part of this discussion and they have to be part of every single step along the way, because ultimately they're the recipients of this and you can't build it without knowing what they actually need. And I do think you need a range of families to offer different perspectives and different points of view.
Yep. Very true. Very true. Well, you both are joining us for the micro keynote at the Psych Summit. And I know we won't get too much into what you're talking about because we hope everybody joins you during the summit. But maybe share a little bit about what core question your session will answer, or how your session may flip the way people are thinking. And maybe I'll start with Dr. Smith and then we'll turn to Marcia.
Mm-hmm. So in my summit, what I'm bringing together is what happens in the NICU as far as feeding support, and then what happens as you're transitioning home, and then what can happen at home afterwards. And to kind of tie it all together, I take the case of a former premature baby and kind of walk you through the transition process and then what happens immediately afterwards. And so because I think oftentimes we work in these little silos, meaning that the hospital providers work in their little silos, and then the community providers work in their little silos, and the family is left to kind of navigate it on their own. And it's almost like the two shall never meet or something like that. And it's not helpful. And I think one of the things which I'm hoping to do is to help people understand that this is really a continuum, and that what happens here and the patterns that are set up here have ramifications for later, and that there are things that we can do better all along this process. And I'm hoping that in just raising people's awareness and understanding how interconnected all of this, I mean, for the families, that's not a question, like, because they know how interconnected it is. And so making sure that providers understand that too, and understand that they do need to reach across the aisle a little bit more. And this is why. So I'm hoping to be able to do that effectively in, you know, my little micro presentation.
You know, and we have research that talks about when families are well supported in the NICU and reading their child's cues about feeding, there are less feeding problems at 6 months than there otherwise would be for families that didn't get that good care in the beginning. And so good care in the beginning and helping it transition to home is so important.
100%. And also, it's really interesting looking at discharge preparation. You know, the number one problem that families have after discharge is usually related to feeding. And it's really unfortunate because everybody's like, well, feeding is so common, meaning everybody has to do it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make it easy, you know? And there are serious ramifications for messing this up early on that linger for years. And so it's imperative that we get this right.
Good point. There are serious ramifications when we mess up. Yeah, good point.
Yep. Well, and Marcia.
Well, you know, it's a psychosocial summit. And so I was thinking from an OT lens in a psychosocial summit. And my general direction is going to be, we need to respect the no. When children, what the psychosocial summit really looks at mealtime interaction, the psychosocial domain really looks at mealtime interaction. And one of the things that happens is that children find their way to us because they've been saying no. No, I can't eat that. No, I can't take volume. No, I don't feel good. The no actually gets them into services. And so I'm challenging us to look at that no respectfully and with curiosity. And how can we navigate that? And also how the no affects all the different domains that we think about in pediatric feeding disorder and ARFID. Yeah. And respecting that no with a curiosity, I think, is going to be fundamental to what we're talking about. And one way I'm flipping that, when you asked about flipping, is that we know that nourishing babies matters. I mean, babies need calories for sure. They need food. But what we know is that how we nourish also matters. And Deborah McNamara has written a book called Nourish, and it's really terrific. And she says, basically, it's not just getting food in children. It's how they get nourished that matters. And so we can look at that as a group, right? How we nourish children and support families matters. Just like you said, Dr. Smith, we can get it really right or we can get it really wrong. So that's the direction I'm going in my short little 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't know about the audience, but I'm excited.
No, the audience is excited, and every speaker that we've talked to has been excited as well. So I think it's going to be a really great session. And what I love about it, too, is that it looks at across the lifespan, because as both of you are hinting at, starting early is so critical because it's building that pathway for what we look like as adults. Like we're helping our little babies, we're helping our kids, but they become adults too. And so that's why we really wanted with this session to look at across the lifespan and that none of this exists in silos. And so why should we?
You know, I think that when babies have really tough time with feeding, and as a feeding therapist, when I meet that baby later in life, undoing the emotional, the trauma damaged, undoing the stuff that went wrong for families is a lot harder than getting it right from the beginning and supporting them from the beginning. So yes, I'm so excited, Dr. Smith, that you're working in the NICU to start that good support there.
And it's so interesting. I felt like you were a plant for me because, like, why is this critical, you know? And it's that exact reason. It's because, like, in the beginning, like when the things are less obvious and the patterns haven't been established, you can make a huge difference then. And you can, in preventing these big problems that come up later, and as opposed to having to go back and correct them, because that is so much harder, you know? It's like, let's just get it right the first time.
The things we're connecting later not only relates to the pattern of eating and growth and those kind of things, but also the relationship with the parent, the connection with the parent, the emotional well-being of the parent and the child. Those things are lifelong relationships and connections that we want to support. And if we get it real wrong in the beginning, it just takes so much more time and it's so harder for each of the individuals.
Absolutely. And it's so funny because people forget how complex feeding really is.
Oh, for sure.
And it's not just the feeble. It's not just the suck, swallow, breathe stuff. There's emotional stuff. There's psychological stuff. There's developmental stuff that's all wrapped up in there too. And so when you're having these feeding difficulties, they are not happening in a vacuum, you know? And so, like, if you can avoid this, you can avoid so much of that other.
I don't know if people forget so much as that they don't ever realize it until it goes wrong.
Yeah.
Until they have issues with it. You don't realize how complex it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's something that Marcia mentioned too. Like that dynamic of the interaction of the families with the kid, especially when it comes time to feed. Because like you don't want to what a failure a parent feels like if they can't feed their kid, because feeding is so basic. And we don't want that to happen. And we don't want the people to feel that way. And we also don't want them going through extremes to try to make something happen that's not quite happening in the right way, because there are ways to do it so that you don't get trauma or PTSD from the families and trauma from the kids, you know? Because feeding should be enjoyable, because you got to do it the rest of your life, you know?
We're plants for each other, Dr.
I was just about to say that, Marcia. You really are plants for each other.
How wonderfully this is. You guys are just perfect, like ping-ponging off of each other. This is wonderful. It's like a match in heaven.
It is. It is.
Like today.
I just wish every child could have you both, like if they're born in NICU, and then just to go on, and it'd be great.
Strong start in life.
Can we just clone you both?
What disciplines, unexpected or expected, do you feel will find your topic especially relevant, and why? And let's start with Marcia on this one.
I hope, Jacqueline, that all four domains of the psychosocial or the pediatric feeding disorder logo, I would like to think all four domains will be appreciative, because what I'm talking about is that we each have our silos. We each have our expertise, and our expertise developed because we're passionate about helping children, and we've done what works with the kids we're seeing and the families we're seeing. And I really believe strongly that it's the overlap that we have. It's what's between us all that's going to be the richness of the future. The richness of my talk is in the middle, between the silos where they all overlap. So I would like to think that everybody takes a little something away from it.
Love that. Thank you, Marcia. Dr. Smith, how about you?
So I'm going to answer it in a slightly different way. I'm going to say the obvious choice, obviously, are the speech and the OT, because they often are the people who do the feeding. And then clearly the parents and the families, because, you know, it's their kid and they have to do this. I'm going to say the people who should also be like interested in this, but sometimes we have to remind them that they need to be interested in this, are like the physicians, the neonatologists, and the pediatricians, because oftentimes they're more focused on other medical issues, and they don't think about this particular issue as much as they should. But a part of what we're trying to do in spreading the word is demystifying this and making them understand this connection. And then obviously, you know, nurses, because nurses do a lot of the feeding in the hospital, and a lot of those dysfunctional patterns are set up. You know, you've heard that, you know, I could feed a rock. You know, we're like, well, maybe you shouldn't be feeding a rock. You know?
So Haley's a nurse.
You've heard this.
She totally knows.
But I wouldn't do that.
Exactly.
It's and not so, you, Haley.
Clearly, like if you've been even close to a NICU, you've heard the NICU nurses who say that. And really, what they should be doing is looking at the infant's cues and listening to them. Like Marcia said, when the infant says no, we should listen. They're saying no for a reason. And so a no right now isn't a no forever. It's the moment. And maybe the next, if we listen to this no, maybe the next time through, it'll be more enjoyable or more pleasurable. Maybe the kid will be in a better space, the infant will be in a better space to do more in their own time, in their own way.
Especially if their parents have learned to read their no's in the NICU. And right. I think it's the NICU researchers that have really taught us about the being responsive to the child's reaction and then adjusting. So your child is saying no, okay, we need to adjust. Think about it differently, support that baby's needs, and then move on. And I believe that if we keep that mentality as we go through life, that where we're responding to the child, as you said, and it's this child in this moment, that will make better headway for a lot of the little ones we're working with.
I feel like I must speak up for my nursing pedigree. I've come from one of those Q-based nursing researchers, so yes.
Yes. Well, and being able to like carry that through throughout the lifespan is so important, because, you know, I think we have like the look at very critical pieces of time in growth and development, but then like build their building blocks forever. And so it's that lifelong appeal too.
Wait, I have to go on the record and say, look, I am not bashing NICU nurses.
No,
I
love NICU
nurses. I could not exist without them. I have learned a ton from them. I'm just talking about a specific mindset that says that
it's the mindset shift. Yeah, yes, that's really
all I'm talking about.
Yep. So Feeding Matters is very focused on system change. And a lot of the way we do that is through shifting mindsets. And that's one thing that you're mentioning is it's that mindset shift. And that's where it's just not as tangible to be able to shift a mindset in that way. And it has a lot of like change management that needs to happen. And it takes a while and several years. And so that mindset shift doesn't happen overnight. And so you're fine, Dr. Smith, you're fine. So in terms of preparing for your session and being able to record it and do that stuff, what were some fun behind the scenes prep work that you did or would like to share? Any fun things? Yeah, Marsha has one.
Give us well, Jacqueline and Haley know me, Dr. Smith. I can't say anything in 20 minutes. There's so much I want to say about feeding. I do 16 and 21 hour courses about feeding. So I just want to talk for a very long time. And 20 minutes, I'm going to say, is much harder than 3 hours, right? So what I did is I have a 20 minute talk and then I have a 4-page handout I'm giving people of resources because I just feel the need to give lots and lots of information. And I will say what's interesting about this particular handout is that it's not a traditional bibliography of research and books. There are those things in it. But what I've highlighted in each section is interviews, podcasts, conversations with people that are having lived experiences. So basically I'm saying to people, hey, these are some of the voices I'm listening to as I'm growing and changing the field, as I hope we all are growing and changing in the field. And so, hey, listen to some of these people and see what you think and determine your own views on some of these topics when you hear some of these different voices. So it's different. So that is kind of a fun pivot that I did in this 20-minute talk.
How about you, Dr. Awesome. Smith?
I would say similar, like 20 minutes is not a long time. And I'm definitely, you're probably picking up on this. I'm a little long-winded, as my grandma would say. Got the gift of gab. Anyway, and so what I did was, you all know Kyla Romeo from Feeding Matters. Like, she helped us so much when we were preparing. She's part of the team we were preparing the guidelines. And so I was like, Kyla, I need to make a talk. It's 20 minutes of like, I'm going to send this to you. Would you mind just checking it out for me and seeing where I could trim it down a little bit? And she was great. She was so loving and wonderful and yet helped me to pare it down a little bit. So I'm hoping it squeezes into 20 minutes, but as I'm going to be recording later today, so I'll be able to let you know. You may have to play at double speed, but...
I already talked double speed, Dr. Smith.
She's always excellent for that. Are there any other summit presentations in particular that you're looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to Marsha's.
And I'm looking forward to yours.
Well, of course.
Well, I'll say I have a couple that I'm pretty darn excited about. The one I'm most excited about to start with is the responsive feeding one that Valerie Gent and Jean Marshall are doing out of Australia, because they're doing some amazing research and it's hard to do that kind of research and they're challenging it and taking it head on. And so I know some of the behind the scenes stuff from that research. So I'm excited about that. I am curious about Christine Cooper-Vince talking about parent feeding behavior and food acceptance, the role of moderating sensory perception. I'm curious about that one. I love the idea that Maddie Dusk is going to be talking about OT supporting interventions for ARFID, because I believe very, very strongly that sensory has a very lot to do with eating and that ARFID has a very lot to do with sensory for very many people. And that I think the role for OT in ARFID, I expect that it's going to be an emerging place for OT in the future. And then I love that you do lived experiences, and always I will celebrate you for that. And then everything else is going to be great, but those were my highlights. I had to pick a few.
Wow, that was pretty extensive. I was going to say, no, I was like, seriously, I was like, that was really great. I thought the program overall looked really great, but I will say the lived experience pieces, I find those are the ones that resonate with me the most, because I think there's nothing like having a person who's kind of been through something talk about their experience and having a face to associate with a challenge, as opposed to thinking about the challenge in a kind of academic way. I think that's the thing that makes it stick with you. Like, if you can go back in your head and say, oh, I'm thinking of little Johnny or little Susie, you know, when it comes to this issue, it makes it a very real issue for you, as opposed to thinking about it like as a condition or diagnosis, you know?
Well, that's so true. That's what we try to do, is like really blend the human emotion and story with the academic side and the research side, because that those two worlds don't always collide very easily. And so we hope that we can be a place of that collaboration to happen and to thrive, which actually brings us to our last question that we have for both of you, which is, this podcast was started because of our family-centered PFD research consortium, where we are ensuring that patients and families and lived experience can lead the research instead of just being subjects in the research. And so one of the things that we always ask our podcast guests is, what do you think are barriers to research being patient and family-centered? And do you have any ideas for solutions? And I know it's a big question and a broad question, so feel free to take it and answer it however you would like to.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go first?
Sure. Yeah. I was going to go with whoever seemed to have an answer first.
Yeah. I always got something to say. I told you. So I think, like, this is something Marcia hinted at a little bit earlier in the talk, in kind of a different category. But I think funding is always a challenge. And I think right now, like, funding is not guaranteed. And like, some of the classic pathways for funding aren't going to be available kind of moving forward. And I think that's something very real that we have to think about. And I think that, like in the same way that we have to be kind of creative in how we use the resources that we have and coming up with new ways to kind of get this into the hands of the people that need it, I think we're going to have to come up with ways to be able to fund, because otherwise this type of research will just stop. You know, and we can't do that. That is not the right answer. And so we have to come up with creative ways that we can continue to support this. And then I also think that, you know, people often think of research as this big mysterious thing, and really is asking questions and then coming up with solutions to the questions in a kind of thoughtful, methodical way. And then, like, making sure that that information gets disseminated. And so I think it's really important that people who are doing this work don't just live in their little silos, that they come out and they make sure that they spread the information out and talk across the aisle, talk to other people who are in this area, in this field, and not just their own specific disciplines. Because I think oftentimes people are in the echo chamber of their own disciplines talking about this. But there are other groups who need to know this information. And some of them, as I've hinted at earlier, neonatologists don't necessarily even know that they need to know this. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who need to know it the most, because they know the least coming in. And when they do that, they can make a lot of assumptions about what they know and about what their experience, and they could do harm in it unintentionally. Mm-hmm. And so which is kind of goes back to that feeding a rock comment, you know. People actually thought that was a good thing at one point and something right. to be celebrated. And
yeah.
Now that we know better, we can do better.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think of barriers. I think of directions in the research in the future. We need a lot more normative charts and guidelines that tell us what should be happening at what age group. But typically, we have looked at milestones as a way to look at feeding. And typically, a lot of the research has looked at number of bites and volumes and growth and weight. And although those are important, and I don't want to negate the importance of those, I also want to say that because feeding is so complicated, feeding also is so much about enjoyment and relationships with the parent and the family, and the parent and the family experience, and the child's experience. And I think as we begin thinking more about qualitative research, I think it's going to be more supportive of the feeding interactions that I'm looking to see in the future. That's more a qualitative interaction, not just about Dr. Smith feeding the rock, not just about getting the bites in, but really looking at what Deb McNamara says in her book, Nourish, that it's that just because the child eats does not mean they're nourished. And so I think we need to look at all those big ways of nourishing children. And if that's important to us, then we have to find ways to research that qualitative component. And I'm not a researcher. And so I love it when there are researchers out there that are willing to do that. And so I think there's some of those kinds of researches coming up, and it's not easy, but thank you for taking on this project of trying to get more research in our field, because we need it.
Absolutely. My last comment about that is specifically thinking about kind of barriers. I think that oftentimes administrators and policymakers look at different criteria and different guidelines when they're coming up with these policies and things. And I think that like being able to have research that kind of links, you know, the feeding challenges and the ways to avoid them to outcomes that really matter to policymakers and to administrators, so then that they can't poo-poo this as kind of soft science.
Yeah, speak the language.
Absolutely. I think that that's one of the ways to kind of overcome those barriers, because ultimately, like, we are all on the same team and we all want the same things, but we may disagree on how we get from point A to point B.
Yes.
And I think that's where the whole discussion piece and crossing the aisle kind of comes in.
I'm going to say one more thing, and that is some of the barriers out there have been beyond the control of the individual clinicians. Insurance says you get 30 minutes. Insurance says you don't get a home visit. Insurance says, you know, there are policies where when I'm doing a lot of teaching, a clinician will say, that's a great idea. I would love that my initial evaluation looked like that, but I get 30 minutes. You know, those kinds of restrictions also are restricting the field and people's ability to have even time to participate in research. So those bigger views could also be added to your list of things to fix in the future, feeding matters.
Well, no, but it's a great point of like, and that's what we always try to think about. If we're looking at like what are the bigger levers to pull, language and being able to communicate in an effective way and talking the right message is really important, and being on the same page in that way. And to your point, Dr. Smith, having those outcomes that matter to who they matter to is also really important, and being able to talk that language too.
Yeah. So if we can show that having quality over quantity of the feeding experience also equates better outcomes for all, right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Those outcomes aren't limited to short-term outcomes. We're talking
about... No, I was just about to say longitudinally. Yeah.
Long-term outcomes. Mm-hmm. The ones that matter and don't build the entrenched problems.
Yep. Tracking outcomes that matter. That'll be something that resonates with our members from the consortium as well, because that's something that they are very interested in as well. Thank you both for this conversation. It's just been amazing. And I would have never guessed that the two of you didn't know each other before this conversation.
Never met today.
Which is just so lovely, because I feel like it has been such a great time to have this conversation, talk about some of the trends, and really get a little preview of what you're going to be talking about at the summit. So for those listeners that are out there, we hope that you join us at the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit, August 22nd. We're available on demand afterwards. And then Marcia, Dr. Smith, just thank you so much for your time, for your passion, for being here with us today. And we'll see everybody next time. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us. It's been great.